Hello and welcome to the Majlis Central Asia podcast at Radio Free Europe, Radio Liberty. I'm Mohammed Tahir, your host here in Washington, D.C. Muslim majority Central Asia, known with its distinct nature of belief system, though vary from country to country in general, the region has not seen the type of religiously motivated security problem like some of its neighboring countries yet. But things are changing. Over the past few years, hundreds of Central Asians have gone to join radical groups abroad. Several organizations with known ties to Central Asia are engaged in fighting in various countries. These are obviously concerning trends, but in recent days, several reports came out by a number of organizations expressing alarm about alleged radicalism in Central Asia, as if the region was turning to a hotspot of terrorism. On today's Majlis, Radio Free Europe, Radio Liberty's Central Asia podcast, we will discuss why are Central Asians becoming the focus of such an alarming reports about jihadists? Where does this impression come from, and how to separate facts from fictions when it comes to reporting about religion in Central Asia? To discuss the subject, I have David Montgomery, who is the director of SIDAR, which stands for Communities Engaging with Difference in Religion, and is author of a book called Practicing Islam, which looks into practice and meaning of the Islamic life in post-Soviet Kyrgyzstan. David, welcome to the Majlis.
Thank you.
Very nice to have you also joining us. Noah Tucker, associate at the George Washington University Central Asia program, also associate with our Uzbek service in Prague. Welcome on board, Noah.
Thank you. Happy to be here.
We also have Edward Lemon, postdoctoral researcher at the Columbia University. Welcome on board, Edward.
Oh, thank you.
And Bruce Panier, editor of Radio Free Europe, Radio Liberty's Central Asia blog, Kishlak Owozi, is joining us. Bruce, welcome to the Middle East.
Thank you.
Great to have you. Okay, with this, let's dive into this. The topic of alleged radicalism in Central Asia becomes such an interesting issue these days. I have at least two reports, one published in a Western media, the other authored by a think tank based in Kazakhstan. Both talks almost in the same language. Some part makes you really scared to death. Obviously, there are also many things in these reports which make sense, but in the absence of solid data, the authors and probably we will be playing lots of guess games today, so we are in the disputed territory. We have a lot to learn on the go, so please feel free to amplify, expand, or disagree directly with points other guests are making. Please don't wait for me to prompt your questions so that we have a lively debate today. So I guess most of us read one of these latest stories that have emerged in various publications, and I know all of you have some level of concern when it comes to their content. Let's start with you, Nova. What is troubling you in these reports?
Well, maybe one of the first things we could say that's troubling is it struck me as you introduced the program when you talked about having seen so many recent reports that describe the area as a new hotbed of radicalization or potentially the next big area to which Islamic radicalism is supposed to spread in the world. It struck me that, in fact, you could have introduced a program exactly the same way 10 years ago, 15 years ago, and 20 years ago. Uh-huh. And in fact, 25 years ago, if we go back far enough into the 1980s, you know, we can trace people have had this same discussion about Central Asia over and over and over again. And for the most part, it's self-reinforcing. It's based on this idea. It's been repeated so many times that it's taken to be true, sort of in and of itself. And I think it's particularly, I say that, you know, not just because it's ironic or just to sound, you know, sort of smarmy, but in fact, in some of the recent journalistic reporting or in editorials that we've seen, these articles specifically link back to the late Soviet period and make these claims that were being made in the 1980s, that there was some sort of organized renaissance of Islamic militancy in the Soviet Union and in the Central Asian parts of the Soviet Union during the Gorbachev years, or even before that, in the 1970s. And these were claims that were made in the 1980s and are now being treated as fact in the present. But the truth is that these claims were based on no evidence at all, really, and in subsequent scholarship turned out to just simply be a very poor description of what was actually happening on the ground.
Right. Anything to add, Edward?
I would agree with Noah that this is certainly nothing new. I think if we look at particularly the Soviet period, you know, titles of books like The Islamic Threat to the Soviet State, Moscow's Muslim Challenge, you know, there was this assumption that if the Soviet Union was going to collapse, it would come from the soft underbelly, you know, it would come from Central Asia. And, you know, a lot of the Western literature on the region at the time called it Muslim Central Asia, you know, that the fact that the population was Islamic was particularly important, and that from this Islamic parallel set of beliefs to communism would come rebellion and revolution and Islamic militancy, perhaps spilling over from Afghanistan. But obviously we haven't seen that happening. I think there are two major problems with a lot of the work that is done on radical Islam in Central Asia. And the first is the assumptions upon which the argument that radical Islam is an existential threat to the region or a major threat to the region is based on. And the first is that poverty and underdevelopment in the region directly contributes to radicalization. And I think the studies that are available by many academics and some think tanks indicate that this isn't the case. I mean, in my own research, I've looked at the profiles of 215 Tajik citizens who've joined Islamic State. And, you know, what we see is that although some of them are from poor backgrounds, many of them are well-educated. You know, 50% of the 215 have at least an undergraduate degree. Many of them are from even quite prominent local families. You know, they're not always, you know, from the poorest groups. So I think that's important. I think second, you know, this link between religion and radicalization, you know, this idea that if society Islamizes, it's automatically going to radicalize. I think this is also often misplaced. And I think here we see a lot of similarities between often what the government is saying and what these Western think tanks and some journalists are saying, you know, that increasing religiosity in society leads down the path, there's a straight path down to radicalization, and that isn't always the case. I think from the available data that we have, and that's, you know, quite limited, you know, the indications are that the vast majority of the Tajik fighters that I've looked at had no formal religious education. You know, they hadn't spent time in madrasas, they had no real knowledge of Islam. So it seems like most of the factors that are contributing to radicalization are in fact non-religious. Okay. And then I think that leads us to the second major problem with a lot of the literature is this paucity of data. You know, there's simply not a lot of information about radical Islam out there, you know, from which we can draw a measurement of the threat. And I think over relying on what is said by officials, which was what a lot of the Western analysts during the Soviet Union did, analysts still do today, you know, leads us down the path to alarmism. I think we need to be very honest about what we can really say about this issue, because ultimately we know less than we actually know.
David, you've been to Central Asia researching about this topic for months, and then you have these reports coming out from Western countries, also from the region itself, like I'm referring to Erlan Karin here, who is the author of one of these reports, kind of raising alarm on this topic. So what is your understanding? What's happening here? First, yes, your impression of the reports and also the opinions that's expressed involving some level of skepticism on that by our panelists today.
Well, I mean, I think both Ed and Noah are right in terms of many of the readings or reports or, you know, editorials, whether it's in the Chicago Tribune, the Washington Post, some of the recent reports coming from the International Crisis Group, as well as the one you mentioned. I think there's factual errors in some of them, which both was alluded to both by Noah and Ed. I also think that there's a bias and a shorthand for what Islam means. And I was thinking about it because, as Noah said, this is the same type of language and rhetoric that took place, you know, 20, 30 years ago. And we see it in other places as well. We saw, for example, there was a very influential book, Balkan Ghost by Robert Kaplan, which had an influence on how the Clinton administration engaged with Bosnia. You know, it was a well-written book, but it didn't have a depth of understanding of the Balkan region. And the message that came out of reading the book was that, you know, these populations have never got along. They've always fought each other, and it was an ethnic issue, right? So that it was understood that ethnicity was shorthand, that people couldn't get along. Whereas the reality was is that people had lived together. They had gotten along. There was intermarriage and all of these things. But people kept telling that story. And because it was an ethnic story that we couldn't do anything about because deep down they just wouldn't be able to work it out, we didn't engage. And I think a similar type of thing happens with regards to Islam. There's a sense that somehow there's a continuation of Islam in its worst cases with ISIS, as to other people who might become more orthopraxic or orthodox in their practice, might lead to radicalization that it doesn't actually play out in Central Asia, where you have people who oppose the state, maybe doing so for reasons that have nothing to do with religion, and the state may be responding by referring to them as radical Muslims. And the idea that somehow Islam is the descriptive factor for opposition can be misleading, because there's often other factors below that that lead people to oppose the state or feel disaffected from the state. So that's one sort of bias, I think, in a lot of the reporting, that somehow there's a problem with people being too Muslim. I think some of this problem also is seen in how Central Asian states engage with it. And you see that in some of the reporting. It's not always an explicit bias or anything that's acknowledged, but there's almost an implicit understanding that if, you know, I think, you know, there was a sentence that came out in the recent International Crisis Group report that really struck me, right? And it was talking about, in the absence of political pluralism, a reliable state and economic opportunities, a growing number of citizens are taking recourse in religion. And for me, that's a sentence that makes it seem as if political pluralism, reliable state, and economic opportunities is related to one being religious or not religious. That's problematic, I think, because there may be political pluralism or reliable state or economic opportunities, and people may or may not be religious. They're not necessarily related. But in a lot of the reports, there's already this assumption that somehow Islam is, if it becomes too Islamic, too active in its practice, it's somehow threatening. And the reason for it being that is because of the failures of the state, whereas the failures of the state may or may not have anything to do with religiosity.
Let's bring Bruce here. You are welcome if you want to add anything to what has been said. My question would be then, why these reports are emerging? Why are Central Asians becoming the focus of these alarming reports about the jihadist stand in this case?
Well, I mean, obviously I agree with what all the panelists have said so far about where these misconceptions find their origins. There's no doubt it's been mischaracterized from the start, pretty much. You know, the reason that I think a lot of the focus has come on the Central Asians now is because a couple of isolated incidents did feature Central Asians. You know, the attack in Istanbul on New Year's Eve. You have a few others like that aren't happening. They're happening outside Central Asia. And then these people are identified as Central Asians. And for some reason, because most people, let's face it, haven't heard of Central Asia, they start to get the idea that, you know, I've read three stories in the last 2 years where Central Asians featured. It must mean that this is a hotbed of Islamic extremism or something. You know, it's just poor, in some regards, poor journalism that no one has done the background research to find out how much of this is true. I mean, you could probably find citizens from, you know, dozens of countries who have been involved in terrorist attacks around the world. And if you wanted to focus on that one country, you'd probably find that in two or three incidents over the last few years, citizens from such and such country took part in it. It doesn't mean that the whole country or the whole region is given to that kind of sentiment. But unfortunately, you know, like I said, we've seen some of these newspaper articles and other reports come out, and they, you know, I guess, just the way they put it, like you said at the very intro, they make it sound so alarming, like this is something you got to watch out for. You know, I won't say which article it was, but there was the one that a recent article, and it has a part that says, you know, I'll do this in the radio voice, but there's another part of the world where Islamic State is rising, a region few Westerners know. And of course, that region ended up being Central Asia, you know, and we know Central Asia because we've been out there. And that's why I know this is not true. But, you know, this kind of stuff, if this is all you know about it, you know, it just kind of perpetuates the reporting. One person reads this and then they'll write up their own article, and this is the kind of stuff that'll feature in it.
That's interesting, Bruce. It seems that we are all in agreement today. Let me play a little bit rule of bad cop here. What I mean is perhaps some of these reports might be taking its sources from the incidents, Bruce, that you alluded to. Here I'm not talking about Uzbekistan or Tajikistan, but countries like Kazakhstan, Kyrgyzstan never had an issue with radicalism. But these days, things are happening. And even if you don't believe to local reports, look at their numbers in Syria, for instance. You never had Kazakh radical fighting among a terrorist group, but now you have them. And you also, Bruce, mentioned a number of explosions happened in the region and also outside of the region. For example, in Kyrgyzstan, like there was some issue with the in front of the Chinese embassy, for instance, last year, and then few explosions in Kazakhstan. And then outside, for instance, like in the Istanbul nightclub shooting, we find out that one of them, at least, was a citizen from Uzbekistan. And then this Istanbul airport bombing last year again, a Kyrgyzstani and Uzbekistani citizens were, according to Turkish media, Turkish authorities were involved in that. So how to explain these incidents? Who wants to take the question?
Well, if I could just jump one second and refer to one thing about the internal stuff. Certainly, and Yerlan Karin refers to attacks in Kazakhstan and Kyrgyzstan in his report, and groups that are there. And he identifies Jaish al-Mahdi in Kyrgyzstan in 2010, and later he talks about Jundal Khalifa in Kazakhstan, which came out in 2011. Now, in the case of both these groups, it was never clear that there really was anybody in these groups except for a few people. Once they were broken up, they never reappeared again. It just looked like a bunch of 13, 14 guys that got together and decided this was going to be the name of their group. They got a lot of publicity. They still are getting publicity, obviously. But there was never any proof that they were really part of any organized group or that they were even linked to any organized known extremist or terrorist group. But and yet still their names appear.
I understand, Bruce, that. But even that wasn't the case in the past, isn't it? I'm just trying to say, you know, some of these phenomena or some of these incidents weren't happening in the past. So how to make sense of this in the light of these
language? All right, well, I'll throw one comment, and then we got to give it to the other panelists.
Yeah, sure.
You know, as far as the people that moved from Kazakhstan and Kyrgyzstan to areas where it's Syria, Iraq, join the Islamic State group, whichever. I'd be real curious to see the data that's produced like a year from now on outward migration. When those people left, when those families were leaving, the Islamic State was on the offensive, and their publicity pretty much internationally said they were winning. And of course, we know that they had their own filtered advertising, which was portraying themselves as some kind of Islamic utopia that they were building. And those were the days when we saw reports of families leaving from Kyrgyzstan and Kazakhstan. I haven't seen too many of those reports, any really, in the last 3 or 4 months.
Yeah.
And I expect that any desire to go and join a group right now that's apparently losing, is not there simply. It was when they were winning and they made it look like it was a great deal, the people would go. Now that they're obviously losing, I just don't see the out-migration to these places anymore.
Yeah. Noah, Edward, David, please jump in.
Yeah, I'd be happy to respond to this one. I'll try to be quick and give others a chance too. I think it is important. I know, as you mentioned, you're playing devil's advocate a little bit, but you know, we cannot, when we say that, you know, the analysis that's done in many of these reports is wrong or it's faulty or it's giving the wrong explanations, this is, of course, not to deny that there is a problem with violence of some kind or not to deny that young Central Asian men have been found participating in violent militant groups in different parts of the world. In fact, you know, the thing is, The issue here is in the analysis. This is to say that I would suggest that rather than one of the more productive ways of looking at this is rather than seeking some sort of grand explanatory theory that's rooted in Soviet history and all of this stuff, is look at the cases themselves and see where the evidence takes us and we have to acknowledge also that the problem is larger than any one of these single conflicts. And the evidence that we see once we look at the larger problem suggests that there's something else going on here beyond Islam or poverty or anything else, in addition to how problematic those are as explanatory factors anyway. And I'll give here one quick example, because we're speaking in broad generalities here. So if you go outside of the Syrian conflict, which is beginning to wane now in a way as each of these groups has suffered serious military defeats, if you go to the Syrian from the Syrian conflict and change your focus up to Ukraine and an area where a conflict is continuing to, we'll say, simmer, I guess, and occasionally break out again into very intense violence, one of the things that you'll find, perhaps surprisingly there, is Central Asians and Chechens there as well. And in some cases, you'll find them even fighting on opposite sides. I just spoke this morning, one of RFE with one of Current Times great reporters, Shakira Tulaganova, who's herself an Uzbek, who was doing field reporting in Donetsk last year and was standing in the airport as they were doing a piece on that, and noticed that there was a young Uzbek there with the pro-Russian militia groups. And she came over, she introduced herself, she was very surprised to find an Uzbek guy there. She struck up a conversation with him, and he told his story. He was an Uzbek from northern Tajikistan, and he said actually that in his words, most of the young men from his village had gone to fight in different theaters, but most of them had gone to fight for ISIS. And he said this young man who's fighting on behalf of Russia, so who's in a on the pro-Russia Ukrainian separatist forces, so he's, and these are groups that use overtly Christian iconography and fight sometimes as militant Christian Orthodox groups. This guy said his first choice was to join ISIS. But the reason that he ended up fighting for the Ukrainian separatists is that he didn't have a foreign passport. So he wasn't able to travel to go to Syria, but he could travel within the former Soviet Union on his Tajik domestic passport. He basically just wanted to fight somewhere. He had nothing else to do in his village. Everybody else was gone. There were no employment opportunities. And he thought that becoming a soldier of fortune was a good career choice for him. And he was, in a sense, agnostic about what side he fought on. You know, it wasn't even about the propaganda of one side or the other. He was a young guy who just wanted to go out somewhere, make some money, have an adventure, and fight. And he was just as willing to fight for an overtly Orthodox Christian militant group as he was to fight for ISIS.
Interesting.
This is David. Yes. I also think that I just wanted to sort of, it's not that we deny that these things are happening. I think that, you know, everyone has sort of suggested that we are concerned about how things get reported and then how that's interpreted by people who know very little about the region. I was looking at the Tribune editorial, and there's this amazing couple sentences where it talks about sort of the repression of Muslim radicalization that continued after the 1991 collapse. And then he goes on saying one of Asia's most dangerous terrorist groups, the Islamic Movement of Uzbekistan, has in the past allied itself with Al-Qaeda and fought alongside Taliban fighters against American troops in Afghanistan. Today, it pledges allegiance to the Islamic State. Now, if I know nothing about the region, I make all sorts of assumptions about the Islamic Movement of Uzbekistan taking over the region. It's really just probably somehow similar, or if not the same, as the Taliban. And yet that doesn't play out in reality. But the message that I walk away with, not knowing anything or having a context or depth of understanding about the region, is that, wow, things are really bad. And they're only going to get worse. And probably the only thing that makes sense to me to explain that is Islam, right? Oh, it's radical Islam. And there's something inherent in radical Islam that's causing this. And I think the problem is this causal assumption that Islam is the driving factor. And as both, you know, as all of the Bruce and Ed and Noah have made clear that there's these other factors that probably play a more significant role than Islam in explaining why there's opposition and explaining these other incidences that take place. And I think we just need to be a bit more critical about that.
Right. Edward, these are new phenomena that we are talking about, either the way this trend being explained by the authorities locally and also the way it's being reported outside of the region. The other fact is the guys that we are talking about today who found involved in these isolated incidents, these are the guys not belonging to this old ideologue of IMU or Hizbut Tahrir. These are some new guys, new kids, whatever the motivations are. Obviously, something is changing. Isn't that the case, Edward?
I would say that the reasons for joining these groups, I guess, as the other panelists have alluded to, you know, I think there are many similarities with, you know, the reason you would have joined up with a militia during the Tajik Civil War, for example. You know, it's about masculine pride. It's about often about local connections. And, you know, if we kind of examine the cases that we have evidence for, you know, where whole villages or large numbers of individuals from villages in northern Tajikistan have gone to fight in Syria, you know, these kind of fictive or real kin ties continue to matter. And I think, you know, I don't think a tremendous amount has changed. I think, you know, the Syrian conflict has offered an opportunity, a theater, a kind of a mechanism for some of these individuals who do want to fight. And as Noah said with his story very interestingly, you know, often it's not a matter of where they're fighting or who they're fighting. You know, it's just the process of fighting and seeking an adventure that appears to be most important for these individuals rather than any kind of religious commitment to jihad. You know, this, you know, the Syrian conflict has offered an increased opportunity for individuals from the region to go and fight. And I don't think a tremendous amount has changed. You know, for example, there was talk that the economic crisis in Russia in 2014, 2015 would lead to a kind of mass exodus to Syria and Iraq. And that obviously hasn't been the case. And I think, as Bruce said, rather than, you know, seeing a rise of ISIS in Central Asia, as the Chicago Tribune article tried to argue, you know, in fact, we're seeing, you know, a rapid fall in the number of Central Asians going to Syria and Iraq.
Great. So I guess we all are in agreement that the nature of traditional or nomadic form of belief system, which Central Asia was known for, is somewhat changing, but not the way it's being reported outside, like if the region was turning to such a hot spot. But what direction this comeback to religion is taking, and what are the triggering points in this transformation? We will continue our discussion talking about this and many other questions shortly. Hey everyone, before we get into the second part of the show, just a quick reminder that if you really like Majlis podcast, there's a real chance that you will also like my other radio show that's called Gandhara Podcast. The show discusses latest developments in Pakistan and Afghanistan from local perspective. And the podcast is published in every second week on Radio Free Europe Radio Liberty's Gandhara website. It's a totally must-follow discussion for foreign policy nerds with interest in the region. First, let me recap the debate that today on the Majlis. We are discussing recent hype among media outlets about alleged rise in radicalism in Central Asia and its possible reasons, facts, and fictions, etc. Discussing the subject with me are David Montgomery, author of Practicing Islam, a book which looks into practice and meaning of Islamic life in Kyrgyzstan, Noah Toker, associate at the George Washington University's Central Asia program, Edward Lemon, postdoctoral researcher at the Columbia University in Bruce, editor of Radio Free Europe, Radio Liberty, Central Asia, blog, Kishlak Owasi. I'm Mohammed Tahir here in Washington, D.C. Welcome back, gentlemen. So this is a common belief, I believe, that in the panel or to the experts that you talk to, that there are exaggeration about level of radicalism, threat, etc. But I guess many people also agree that level of religiosity has been growing since the collapse of the Soviet Union. So what are the signs that it is happening, David?
The sign that there's greater religiosity? Is that the question?
Yeah.
I mean, I think that there's sort of two things, and one perhaps helps explain the way in which we've struggled with how Islam is portrayed in the media is, you know, Central Asia came out as a pretty secular place. Yeah. Islam was largely privatized. It wasn't something that was seen or expected to have any active public role. It was to be largely, you know, a cultural, this is during the Soviet Union and after the Soviet Union, it was supposed to be largely cultural. And part of that has to do with, I think, the leadership throughout the region were people who were largely secular. And a secular state is worried a bit about religion. And in some ways, it sees the need to be protected from religion. You know, on the other hand, many people who have been trying to make sense of, you know, their challenges in the world, both existential, but also physical challenges, whether it's making ends meet, employment, or whatever, are always looking for ways of making sense of meaning and their communities. And you have people who are finding religion as, you know, Islam especially, but other forms of Christian practice. They're finding religion as something that helps explain the types of struggles. They're engaging with it at different levels. It's incredibly complicated and diverse. And to say that someone is Muslim is hard to understand what that means, because it doesn't mean one thing. It means many things to different people at different times. And I think that, you know, one story that I think becomes really important in terms of understanding it is the Tablighi Jamaat movement.
Right.
Because you have a group of people who have become more orthodox and more orthopraxic in their practice. And they go around to different villages and they'll pray in mosque with people who they probably would not have known before. And they maybe go for 3 days, they go for a week, they go for 40 days, whatever, but they're always moving around. Now, this scares a state that's uncertain what Islam might mean. My guess is it scares it not because of the substance of what's being preached so much as the fact that you have different connected groups than you've ever had before. There's a deeper connection. Now these groups know not necessarily only the people in their community, but they know people in other communities, and they can mobilize more quickly. And this is terrifying to a state that's concerned about opposition.
Obviously, we are not anymore talking about the fighting guns and Central Asians being radicalized, whatever. But the simple fact that the people are returning to their religious ideologies at some level. You have seen like number of mosques being opened, number of churches probably being established over the past several years, and you have seen young girls, some of them, wearing hijabs, which wasn't the case. So we are just discussing to understand the background of this in a way that how people are returning. What are the signs that people are returning to religion? So anyone, Edward, Neva, Bruce, floors are yours. You're jumping.
Yes, well, you know, I mean, I was there when they were starting out. Certainly in 1992, when I actually got to travel around a lot, there weren't hardly any mosques in the place at all.
Right.
It was actually part of my sociological survey. One of the questions was, which building would you like to see appear in your village? And the unanimous answer over the course of 21 months was a mosque. If you travel Central Asia now, the mosques are everywhere. And of course, you know, the former atheist leaders of these countries are now competing to have the biggest and fanciest mosque in their capitals. So it's, the signs are there all over the place. I think one of the big problems they had in the early 1990s that they paid for later was that first, because they wanted something to clearly divide them from their former Soviet past and from Russia and Moscow, the Kremlin in particular, they invited all kinds of different Muslim groups to send people. When I was there certainly in 1992, I used to run into Saudis and Pakistanis all the time. And they were there as missionaries for various sects of Islam. And it took the governments in the region a while to figure out that not all of those sects were probably somebody that they wanted in their country. And then they started weeding out some, picking and choosing which ones were kind of acceptable and which ones were less acceptable, to the point where now they're none of those groups really are acceptable. The state's developed its own form of Islam in the meantime, but certainly the people from the very start gravitated toward the religion. They wanted to know more about it, and they never forgot. The ties weren't broken during the Soviet Union. They were thinned, but this was one of the things that they really wanted, and so I was hardly surprised at all when I see the way people have re-embraced Islam in the region today.
Right. Noah, Edward, feel free to jump in. Though there are some distinct tribes, but historically Central Asia is made up by multicultural, multi-ethnic societies. So does this evolution of belief has been taking place equally in all religions, or we are talking only about Islam?
I don't know. I mean, it's so problematic to figure out what sort of word to pick for this. And this is something that, you know, among scholars, you know, sociologists and anthropologists in particular, you know, we've spent a lot of the last 15 years or so trying to figure out what exactly to call this and how to describe it. I mean, it's problematic to talk of it as a return, although lots of people describe it that way themselves. But, you know, you can't go back in time. You're not turning back the clock to something else. In fact, you're moving on to something new. If you're doing something that you didn't do before, and you didn't do that before in your life, but you perceive that your ancestors did, you're not going back to the same thing that they did. You're doing something new for yourself. You're opening up a new territory. And what we see, in fact, in Central Asia is that people have done all sorts of things. There is no uniformity in this sort of return, quote, to Islam. There are all kinds of people who have found many different ways to describe their lives as religious or to factor religious beliefs into their lives. And many of them have nothing to do with what we would in the West talk about as Islam or what groups that we don't like, you know, like these violent Islamist groups like Al-Qaeda or ISIS, anything that they would describe as Islam themselves. I mean, if you are David can speak better to this because he's done great field work on this specifically. But one of the things that I always enjoy about Kyrgyzstan is that if you ask someone in Kyrgyzstan how they imagine sort of the religious landscape around them or how they practice their religious life, they talk about this landscape where the entire country, the natural features of the country around them is alive with religious meaning. That you will you'll climb this mountain or go to this lake, go to this specific place because it has a religious meaning for them that often they connect to hundreds and hundreds of years of tradition. Whether or not that's literally true or not, that's the way that they understand it. And in many cases, these are, you know, like geologic formations, mountains and rivers and lakes that have been there longer than human settlement and that have a deep religious meaning to people. So the idea of what it means to return to Islam means something very different in different places. And we see a return to, or I don't know if we would even call it a return, I guess we see an embrace of religious values and religious communities across a spectrum of religions as well. It's not just Islam.
Edward, you've been quiet today. Anything to add into this discussion? I mean, what I was referring to is like Noah explained that very nicely, saying embracing their religion or their belief system. So what kind of signs are you seeing? And also, is these signs equally applied to all the people with religious backgrounds, whatever they are, Christian, Judaism, or Islam, or you are seeing this only in Islamic societies?
Well, I think, you know, in places like Tajikistan, it is easiest, obviously, to express your Islamic faith. But in Dushanbe, I knew a number of Christians who certainly converts to Christianity rather than ethnic Russians or Ukrainians. These were ethnic Tajiks who'd converted to Christianity. And, you know, they would go to their Bible study groups and they would obviously, you know, they were fervent believers in the faith. But obviously they couldn't express that to their friends. They couldn't even express it to members of their family because of the fear that they would be stigmatized or disowned. So I think, you know, in a place like Tajikistan, you know, certain religious groups maybe operate under, or all religious groups operate under some level of some dialectic against the state, the secular state. But, you know, non-Islamic groups, non-traditional religious groups in general, you know, operate under even more pressure. And I think it's very difficult for them to express their piety publicly. And the same goes even for certain individuals, you know, who are too Islamic, or, you know, as David was saying earlier, people who are wearing beards, people who are women who are even wearing the hijab in a place like Tajikistan, do face, at least depending on the kind of community they live in, you know, are certainly open to facing certain pressures from the state, pressures from other members of the community. So I think it really, you know, I think there's a revival, or I guess, as Noah said, an embrace of religion, but there's certainly, you know, limits on the way in which people can show parallel forms of religion, I guess. Mm-hmm.
I want to add one thing, if I can, or maybe two, just to sort of disaggregate it a bit. So, it's what we're talking about in terms of people being more expressive of their religion. I think it's important to distinguish that. I don't think that has a lot to do with the first part of our discussion about the reporting, in the sense that, I mean, clearly people do shorthand. They say, okay, well, there's an issue with these Islamic groups, and now we see people who seem to be more religious, that there's somehow some relationship between those two. And I don't think there is. I think that you have people who are becoming religious, and one becomes religious within one's lifetime. So it's, you know, they may connect it back to, you know, it has always been this way. It's our tradition, and we learned this from our ancestors. We're returning to that. Or it may be looking external, that we want to have sort of a more rigorous moral frame of understanding our life. And we look to whether it's the Muslims we've met in Saudi Arabia, in Turkey, in India, Pakistan, or whatever. But I think one way to understand religion that I think is productive is as a moral framework for getting through life. Now, there's many. It doesn't have to be religion. Communism was one sort of moral framework that allowed people to understand how to get by in the world. But religion gives a ideology that goes from birth to death and how to deal with all of those things. But that in and of itself, this sort of individual struggle that people are trying to make sense of, right, in very real terms that are local, that are connected to their families, they're connected to their neighbors, connected to the state and the broader world in which they're living. They're trying to make sense of these things. That is not a straight line to get from there to, you know, a sentence that the Islamic movement of Uzbekistan is connected to all of these other groups, and that somehow because you have one person in a village who becomes more religious in their practice, that there's a connection. So I just want to sort of make sure that we separate these things. Obviously. Because a lot of times when we talk about the increased expression of religious practice, we get easily seduced to thinking that this indicates that somehow there's greater support for ISIS or for other groups. And it is because people have become more religiously practiced. They practice religion more often. Right. And that the secular state is actually justified in cracking down on these populations.
Obviously, very interesting discussion. Unfortunately, we have to end the debate. But let's end that debate with something that we were talking earlier about these reports, some exaggerations on Western media. Whatever is happening in terms of revival of religion, that's a separate story. But the other part is that some people go out of their way and joins these groups. The problem that leads to some people go to Syria, some people go to join fighting in Ukraine, for instance, whatever purpose they are. Authorities are also failing to address that. So what to do about that specific issue going forward, that it is not really becomes a big issue in the region?
I would say, related to tie everything together, and it's not to say that this is a causal factor for people to become more religious or any of these things, but I think one of the things that we often neglect, or in this discussion often gets neglected, is that the people, especially in the peripheral parts of the former Soviet Union, these were peripheral states to the Union, and within each of these states there are peripheral parts, like southern Kyrgyzstan, for example, which is cut off even from the rest of Kyrgyzstan. And this is the area where we see most militant recruitment and ethnic conflict and other social problems. And I think we can't overlook the fact that one of the primary experiences of the last 20 years for people there, you know, from the fieldwork interviews that I've done and living there for a time myself, is this sense of just a profound collapse of social order since the fall of the Soviet Union. It's not so much, I think, that people look for an ideology all the time to tell them how to live their lives or that sort of thing. We do, you know, we need a moral system that tells us how to navigate our lives. But we used to talk about there being this sort of ideological vacuum that would bring people into religion. I think what I see in people, or what I hear them tell me, is that they've seen their social order completely collapse to the point where you don't know which side of the street people are going to drive their cars down. You know, there are, if you are rich enough, you can drive the wrong way down a one-way street as fast as you want, and the police will do nothing about it. And you can get into car accidents and kill people, and the police will do nothing about it. You know, this is in Tajikistan, this is something that happens over and over again, where the son or daughter of a rich official will be driving drunk or on drugs, driving in a very heavy SUV, run down pedestrians, and there are no consequences for them. And this is the kind of collapse of social order that many people have experienced. And I think that addressing those problems will help address many of the other problems, you know, and good. There are many good religious associations that people turn to in order to try to fill those gaps in a positive way. And it's really important that we differentiate between positive associations and negative associations. You know, if the people are joining together to fund a water pipe or a sewer line to their village, then we shouldn't care whether they do that in the name of an Islamic organization or a Christian organization or an organization of people who are left-handed. But on the other hand, if they're creating an organization to take up arms and overthrow their government, then we should care about that. Again, whether they're doing it in the name of Islam or whether they're doing it in the name of people who are left-handed.
Right. Okay. Similar question to you, Bruce, or Edward, David, whoever wants to jump in. So whatever the causes are, either driven by any sort of belief system or economic issues, the fact that some people went abroad to join groups, incidents took place locally, and current strategies of the authorities are failing to address this. So what to do now?
Yeah, I think I agree that the current strategies are in many ways dysfunctional. I think the kind of major thing is that, you know, there have been a few thousand people from the region who've gone to Syria and Iraq, but government kind of assertively secular government policies that kind of securitize any form of religion that doesn't fall outside of the very narrow confines of kind of state approved practices. The grouping together of groups like the Islamic Renaissance Party in Tajikistan with Tablighi Jamoat, Hizb ut-Tahrir, and Islamic State, all of which, you know, have some kind of link to Islam, but all of which are obviously very different organizations. You know, this kind of broad brush policy, you know, has affected tens of thousands of people in the region. And I think, you know, regardless of whether these policies have any effect on countering radicalization, they certainly have a major impact on the lives of these individuals and their ability to practice religion freely and their ability to openly explore their religiosity and, as Noah said, you know, their ability to kind of mobilize as communities to solve the problems, you know, that the state is simply not there to resolve. And I think, you know, that's the great tragedy, I guess, of kind of these heavy-handed counter-radicalization policies in the region. And this is, you know, potentially detrimental to the kind of social development of Central Asian republics in the long term.
Briefly, David and Bruce.
I think that also gets to why we're so concerned about the reporting of and the accuracy of reporting on Islam and the region is because a lot of the issues, a lot of the problems really are more complex. And you have to be responsible in presenting that picture, because if you purely accept the narrative of the state without questioning it, it becomes pretty simple, right? It's just the problem is somehow with Islam. It has something to do with people radicalizing. And so we crack down and we do that. Whereas I think, you know, Noah and Ed both articulated well that the issues probably are less around that, right? There's things within people's villages, within their cities that can be addressed that have, you know, nothing to do with one's religious practice. But, you know, the challenge that they see, whether it's, you know, the state itself, or how the state is not responding in the way that gives them a sense of well-being and contentedness, that those can be addressed. And I think it would go very far to addressing a lot of the issues that people are really concerned about.
Bruce, shortly.
Central Asia is the territory of Islam. I mean, there's other religions functioning there, but historically, this is an area of Islam. It's incumbent upon the governments of the region to have a greater understanding of Islam. And I'm not saying that they have to turn their countries into an Islamic state, but the leadership has to understand exactly what the religion is all about, school themselves a little bit in it. They attempt to demonize it for their own purposes all the time when it suits their purposes. And this is unhelpful because it is the religion of the region, and it's going to be. And the example I would offer of that is these attacks in Kazakhstan last year, where the government has been very quick to blame this on religious extremism, the stuff that happened in Aktobe, the shooting in Almaty, when in fact there's no link at all. And I think there's no clearer proof that there's no link than the fact that supposedly these were inspired by Islamic extremists, but no Islamic extremist group ever took credit for these attacks at all. So it's counterproductive to tell your population who are Muslims that the threat is the nasty Islamic extremist that you can't define, but is there somewhere or another. They need to lighten up a little bit on that and get a better understanding of what the religion, what it offers that's positive to its population.
Thank you, Bruce Hanier, editor of Radio Free Europe, Radio Liberty, Central Asia blog, Kishlak Owozi, for insightful comments and thoughts. David Montgomery, author of Practicing Islam, a book which looks into practice and meaning of Islamic life in Kyrgyzstan. Noah Toker, associated with the George Washington University Central Asia program, and also associate with Radio Free Europe, Radio Liberty's Uzbek service. Edward Lehman, postdoctoral researcher at the Columbia University. Thank you, gentlemen, very much for your time and thoughts today.
Thank you.
And this is it from me, Mohammed Tahir, host of the Majlis, Radio Free Europe, Radio Liberty, Central Asia podcast. Until next week, bye-bye.